Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Stephen Sewer. I chair the club's LGBT member forum and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker this evening is civil rights attorney and author Frederick Hertz. Fred Hertz graduated from Bolt Hall in 1981, clerked with the Minnesota Supreme Court, and subsequently earned a master's degree from the University of California at Berkeley. Go Bears. Fred currently practices real estate law, mediation, and non-traditional family law in Oakland, where he has counseled hundreds of same-sex couples over the past 30 years. Fred has authored 3 books on the subject of lesbian and gay partnership law. He speaks and writes nationally about marriage equality and is a regular commentator on the Proposition 8 trials for KGO Radio in San Francisco. His NOLO Press book, Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partners, and Civil Unions, which has been updated this year, is the go-to resource for LGBT partnership planning. He has appeared on national television and radio, including The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, All Things Considered, and Talk of the Nation. He is also frequently quoted as the nation's gay divorce expert in national publications, including the New York Times, The Advocate, and the Los Angeles Times. Please welcome Fred Hertz.
Thank you very much, and thank you for this opportunity. Actually, my current favorite gig is I am the gay divorce blogger on the Huffington Post divorce section. They don't have a gay divorce section. But it was really funny because when I proposed it to them and they were a little wondering about it, I said, you know, gay people have been fascinated by straight divorce for decades. It's about time that, you know, straight people get to read about gay divorce. So that's what I am doing. So I wanted to start with a little thought experiment. So imagine, I'm looking around the room, most of you were around 10, 15 years ago, and imagine you were in a cocktail party and a friend said to you, my friend gathered his daughters at the family's weekend home on Long Island and asked the daughters a question. Wasn't it time that he married their father? Wasn't it time that he married their father? And then you went on and asked and said, hey, have you heard that on the lawn of Gracie Mansion, under a tent packed with city officials, the mayor will pronounce Mr. Mintz and Mr. Feinblatt husband and husband? And you said, when do you think we're ever going to see that in the New York Times? You probably would have said, you know, after my lifetime, you know, in 20 years. But in fact, that was in last week's New York Times. And then if you were lawyers and you were sitting around and you were, you know, having more sophisticated conversations about things, you'd say, now, isn't it true the federal government has played a significant and regrettable role in the history of discrimination against lesbian and gay couples? And state and local governments have long discriminated against gays and lesbians. And private discrimination has been pervasive and continues to this day. And then you said, yeah. And then the other person said, and just as a person's gender, race, or religion does not bear an inherent relation to a person's ability or capacity to contribute to society, a person's sexual orientation bears no relation to ability to perform or contribute. You'd be labeled a kind of a radical left-wing gay rights advocate. In fact, I just quoted from the Department of Justice's brief in the case of Galinsky involving a woman who was trying to get health insurance benefits through the federal court system for her wife. So I tell you those things to say a lot has happened in the last 10 years. And I think if one were observing social trends, it would be hard to imagine a social movement with such dramatic changes. And I want to just put that out there to say this is really where we are now. It's been a dramatic 10 years. And in fact, the last 5 years has been so dramatic that when a group of us put together a study group 5 years ago to start dealing with the changes, with the lawyers and accountants and tax people talking, we had a couple of meetings. And then we said, well, do we need to keep meeting? And we're still meeting now 7 years later, and I want to thank that group and also thank another study group that I'm a part of, which includes lawyers and therapists talking about many of the issues facing our community, because it, one of the things that enables people like me to do the work I do and speak on this is that the San Francisco Bay Area is a wonderfully collaborative area where lawyers and therapists and accountants are working together. And one of the benefits that you have living here is actually the access to professionals who really know this stuff. So I just wanted to put in a plug for that. So what I'm going to talk about in about 30, 35 minutes is basically what has happened till now, what I think is going to be happening in the next year or two, and then how does it affect couples who are trying to decide how to organize their lives now. And my three sort of mantras or aphorisms are winning through losing, which I call the lessons of New York and California. Be careful what you wish for, which I call the challenges of equality. And then my last point, which is on the more personal note for each of you, which is that marriage is a right and not a duty. Okay, so where do we stand politically? So right now, as of this month or by the end of this month, we have same-sex marriage available in Iowa, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and the District of Columbia. Now, what's interesting about that is that it's not necessarily, if you were to do a sort of list of where you think are sort of the liberated zones of the United States, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire would not come to mind. But in fact, they are very libertarian places. For a while, a couple of years, it was like you had to have a state that touched an ocean in order to get same-sex marriage. And now things have moved inland a bit. But it's interesting sort of what the map is of that. And what people who have done studies talk about say that it has to do with a libertarian attitude, sort of get off our backs, somewhat anti-government attitude, and a lack of fundamentalist religious participation seem to be the main indicators of where this is going to change. And what's also interesting is that each state has had its own history. So Vermont went to civil union, then to marriage. New York had been the most conservative in so many ways and now has become quite open. There's some front row seats here. Don't be shy. And so each state has had its own trajectory. Now, we have something that I call marriage equivalent. My political friends don't like it. They think it should be called marriage alternative. In the book, we sometimes call it marriage light. It's states that have laws that say all the rights and duties of marriage, but not its name. So those are, again, mostly in the West Coast, actually, Hawaii now, Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, somewhat of a surprise, Illinois, a big surprise because that had been very conservative before, just recently Delaware and Rhode Island, and then for a long time New Jersey. And these are all states where there is a regime, it's either called domestic partnership or civil union, where you have all of the state rights of marriage. Now, I want to just stop here and talk a little bit about what's so interesting about that. So first of all, in what I thought was a wonderful sense of how times had changed, my partner was going through some old clippings a few years ago and came across an article written in the year 2000 about the Vermont Civil Union and how transformative it was and how liberating it was that gay and lesbian couples could have all the rights and duties of marriage. It was celebrated as a tremendous victory, which it was. But what's so interesting is that a mere 10 years later, it's now looked at as second class. I got in rather big trouble at the other room a couple of years ago when there was a talk about this subject, And there was a group of people who were asking about domestic partnership and how it's second class. And I said, well, you know, I'm a pragmatist. I'm a lawyer. If the bus is going to take me where I want to go, I don't mind sitting in the back. It didn't go over very well. But what I try to explain to people, and I actually found it helpful, and it's relevant to the Prop 8 case in a way I'm going to explain in a minute, is that what that sort of quip has brought to the surface is that the difference between domestic partnership and marriage is about dignity and status, not about practical benefits. And what's interesting about the turn of that is that there was a big effort when the Prop 8 case came along to try to find practical problems with domestic partnership. And the San Francisco city attorney called me and said, well, what is the main problem with domestic partnership versus marriage? And in fact, there were like one or two tiny little corners of law that were different. And that actually, that conversation, in fact, in part inspired the city attorney to take a different tack, which is to say, granted, you have all the same practical benefits. The whole reason for not calling it marriage is to stigmatize people by saying, okay, there is this room of marriage, and straight people get to go in the front door, and gay and lesbian people have to go in the back door. And that is, and so ironically, and this came up in the Prop 8 case that I'll talk about in a minute, that feature of the distinction, rather than becoming a reason to accept domestic partnership, well, it's really the same as marriage, got transformed into the argument why we should reject domestic partnership, because its only purpose was to stigmatize people. And I think, as you'll see in some of these discussions and some of these cases, it's actually been a very effective strategy because it is the truth and it's brought it out. I want to actually point out something which we'll talk later about in the practical issues, is what I think is the real consequence of having it be domestic partnership versus marriage, which is that a very, very large majority of people who are domestically partnered don't know that they're under marital law. And the people who deal with them don't know that they're under marital law. And there's three reasons why that's happened. One is there are lots of varieties of domestic partnership. Going back to 1968 and 1970 in Berkeley, the concept of domestic partnership was created at a local level to give people very limited rights, city benefits and things like that. So you have city domestic partnership, you have state domestic partnership, and in California, in a very unfortunate move, when domestic partnership was transformed into marital law in 2003, unlike New Jersey, which changed its term from domestic partnership to civil union, California kept the same term and retroactively called people domestic partners, I mean, included pre-registered domestic partners, previously registered, under marital law. And that confused a lot of people. They don't even remember where they were. The other piece of it, and this is goes to the symbolic aspect of it, is that the rituals of marriage actually are very useful. I always like to remember that my father, even when he remembered very little else in life, knew the date he'd been married. He was married, because that was celebrated every year. It was a big deal. There are witnesses. There's something called solemnization, which means that you have to have an officiant come in and pronounce you husband and husband. But domestic partnership, you know, you double park in front of the mailboxes, etc., run in and get it notarized, and hopefully remember to mail it in. What day did it happen? Who signed it? It doesn't have the solemnization. Now, the other feature of it, and this is something where I somewhat part company with some of my colleagues, is that the political pejorative labeling of domestic partnership is not really the same as marriage has confused a lot of people, especially those high-earning, I will say, lesbians who discover that, in fact, they now have to pay spousal support because, in fact, it was equivalent to marriage, and when they break up, they find out it was. There are gay men who are equally angry about it. But the political classification of domestic partnership as being inadequate or insufficient and not the same as marriage has led to a great confusion on people's part when they learn that, in fact, legally speaking, it is the same. Okay, so those are the states that have domestic partnership. And then there are the states that don't have any of these regimes of their own but will recognize out-of-state partnerships or marriages to some degree. And those are basically New Mexico, Wyoming, and New York was to some degree. The other, and then there are these light domestic partnerships in Maine, Colorado, and Wisconsin. But basically what you have a situation now, and this is creating much of the problems that we have now, which is that you have about 15 states in the District of Columbia that have full recognition. You have four or five states that have partial recognition. And then you have 30 states that have no recognition. And some of our biggest problems and some of the most difficult legal cases have come from people who either lived in or traveled to one of the recognition states, got married or registered, and then went elsewhere, and either are trying to get benefits or trying to get divorced. And this patchwork by having all these different states is clearly creating an unstable situation, which leads me to why I think New York is so important. Despite what people in California might think, New York really is the center of the U.S. economy and the center of power. And I think that it's no coincidence that all of this discussion about divorces and taxes and social acceptance is really bursting forward in response to the New York decision and vote, because you're going to have now all of these officials in or executives at Merrill Lynch, at Goldman Sachs, at the UN, who are going to be dealing with married couples. And those people, you know, they have a lot of friends in Washington, and they have a lot of friends everywhere. And so the problem of the New Yorkers who are getting married and the problems with interstate recognition and out-of-state recognition and federal non-recognition, I think are really going to come to a head. When people ask me when is there going to be marriage nationwide, I said it's when Merrill Lynch gets sued by the surviving partner for having inadvertently released the husband's IRA without checking that it was under marital law because they didn't know what a civil union or domestic partnership was. That's when we're going to start having corporate America saying, this makes no sense. I mean, we have these, in our discussion groups, we have these hypotheticals of, imagine this person lived in New York and went to Vermont and got married and then bought a house in Delaware and then inherited a vacation cottage in Michigan and then moved to Texas and got divorced and broke up. And then somebody calls you. It's really amazing. Like the next week, somebody calls you and says, hi, I'm from New York, and I went to Vermont, and I got married. But one of the issues about places like New York and Washington, which also bring this out, is the multi-state nature of the geography. You know, I gave a talk in Baltimore, and, you know, Virginia doesn't even recognize private contracts between gay couples. So you have these people who are in, they go out to dinner and they've gone to another state. You know, it's very hard for couples, and you're trying to deal with estate planning and all these things, and you have people who own a house in Delaware, work in D.C., and have a primary residence in Virginia, and you're trying to do their legal work, and it's just crazy. So I think New York is going to be very, very influential. Now, what's happening with Defense of Marriage Act? About 3 years ago, I asked somebody, when do you think DOMA will be gone? And they said the first year of Obama's second term. I'm now pegging it. It's going to be April 2013. And I say that for the following reasons. So we've got A lawsuit in Massachusetts brought in part, one, there's two of them, one brought by the state of Massachusetts and one brought by a group of people, including Representative Jerry Studs' widow, claiming that the second part of DOMA, or it's actually part three of DOMA, is unconstitutional. Just for the legal nerds here, part two talked about no state should have to honor another state's marriage. Part three said the federal government would not recognize a same-sex marriage. And it's that second, it's that part three that everyone is talking about. And the trial courts said DOMA was unconstitutional. So that's now on appeal in the Second Circuit. We have out here in California, we have the wonderful decision by Vaughn Walker that ruled that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional. And that now is on appeal, although it's on hiatus because the issue of standing came up. How many of you know what the concept of standing is? Oh, you got a smart group here. Okay. So there's this question of whether standing, whether the proponents of Prop 8 had the right to appeal the Vaughn Walker's decision because the state of California elected not to appeal. And the Ninth Circuit decided to duck the issue and send it over to the California Supreme Court, who will make a ruling. And if they rule that there is standing, which I predict they will do, then it will go back to the Ninth Circuit. There's two rounds at the Ninth Circuit because there's a three-judge panel who makes an initial ruling, and if a majority of the justices want to question that ruling, then an en banc or in whole group makes the ruling. So we're looking at least 2 years before it gets out of the Ninth Circuit. Sort of why I have this April 2013 model, because I think it's going to take 2 years to get out of the Ninth Circuit on Prop 8. So you've got these two tracks. They're legally somewhat different issues, obviously, DOMA and Prop 8. And I think the consensus now is that the opposition will fail on both fronts. The prediction on DOMA is that actually Congress will repeal it. And they will repeal it because they will see the court coming down the line and they're going to want to avoid a court ruling on it. I think everyone wants to avoid it going to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I think it's going to be thrown out by the legislature before there ever is a final vote at the U.S. Supreme Court. I think if once the Second Circuit on the Massachusetts cases or the Ninth Circuit on the Galinsky case, the one involving the woman whose wife is denied benefits, I think that there will be these appellate rulings, and then before it gets to the Supreme Court, Congress will reverse it. Important things to know about the Respect for Marriage Act. I don't know. These words are like defense of marriage, respect for marriage, you know, obsession with marriage. You know, we should call it the Obsession with Marriage Act. That once federal recognition exists, it will only be to married couples, not state-registered couples. I don't think the federal government is going to create a third category. And in fact, apropos of that, one of the pieces that I saw in the Times this week is that New York employers are already starting to say, now that you have marriage, it's the only option. We allowed civil union domestic partnership registration because you couldn't have marriage. And this trend, and Judy Stacey, who's in the room, could talk a lot about this, but this trend to put everyone into this two-category box that only has single and married is a trend that is being reinforced by this, and so the alternatives of domestic partnership are now being excluded from benefit coverage in places like New York, as they are now in California once we had marriage. So I think what's going to happen is that if you want the federal benefits of marriage and you're in California, if Proposition 8 has already been repealed, then you can marry in California. If you want the federal benefits and Proposition 8 has not yet been repealed, you will need to go to Iowa or Vermont or one of those states to get married. The other piece that's likely to happen, and this is a political compromise that Barney Frank proposed, which is that if there is federal recognition, it would only be for people who lived in states where their state recognized the marriage. Because if you think of it ironically, if there was federal recognition, you then would have people in Utah who would be state single and federally married, which upsets a lot of people. So I think we're going to have this situation where the federal benefits will only extend to people who live in recognition states. One of the things just to be aware of for the non-recognition states, curing those problems is going to take a long time, because for most of those states, there are constitutional amendments that require a vote of the populace. They cannot be changed by the legislature. I think if I recall, in 26 of the 30 non-recognition states, it takes a vote of the population to change it. One last thing about Proposition 8 here in California, which has been the debate about whether to put it back on the ballot in 2012. To my surprise, a lot of the leaders of the movement are leaning against putting it back on the ballot for 2012. A year ago, people were like, gung-ho, we're going to do it. I think there's a fear that it will generate, an outpouring of conservative votes such that even if Prop 8 is repealed, it will cause harm, presidential election and other such things. And I think the hope is that the court appeal will address it without having to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. So in summary on this issue, I think one can assume that marital law is available in about half the country now, in one form or another, the back seat or the front seat, the back door or the front door, and that there will be federal recognition in 2 or 3 years. And I think that when people are trying to plan their lives, because you can't put your life on hold while all this political change happens, I think that's the safest way to do your planning. Not perfect, not for sure, but it's the safest way to do it. And the main people who really need to be concerned are those who live in or are going to move to a relocation state. Think twice before you take that job offer in Salt Lake City if you are dependent on your partner's benefits, because you may not be well received in Salt Lake City. Okay, so where does that leave us in terms of individual decisions? And this is where I want to just shift gears for a few minutes and talk about the problems that individual couples face. So as you see, we've got two choices here, married or registered or single. And California does allow you to make some adjustments. You can have a prenup or a postnup or a pre-reg or a pre-dup or whatever you want to call that. And let me point out that thanks to a good bill passed, put in by Mark Leno a couple years ago, if you're a Californian and you go out of state and marry, you will have all the rights and duties of marriage, even though you couldn't get married in California. Now, we're still advising people that they should also domestically partner, because there's some concern that that law might get thrown out eventually. So we are encouraging people to also domestically partner. So what I want to talk about is now this issue of what I call marriage as a right and not a duty. One of the things that has most troubled me is the people who have felt that now that they've worked so hard, they have a duty to get married. I got in an awkward conversation with a client of mine who came to me for a prenup, and he said, I don't want any spousal support. I don't want any community property. We are self-employed. We don't have any benefits from each other, but we're going to get married. And I was like, now, why are you paying lawyers $5,000 to opt out of every single thing that marriage gives you? You could have all of that for free. Just don't get married. And it was sort of caught him up short. And he said, well, our community has fought so hard for these rights. I should, you know, I should enjoy them. And I said, you know, I don't know any straight people that got married just because they had the right to, you know, and their percentages aren't so good. And I just said that I really think, first of all, that's not a reason to get married. And also, something where my thinking has really changed is that for couples who really wanted to create a life as a family, many of the rules of marriage actually make sense. And so if you don't want those rules, where you, especially in California, where your assets are shared, you're on the hook for debts, you really have become a single economic unit. If you really don't want that arrangement, maybe marriage doesn't make sense for you. And that we should not be confusing commitment, validation, and marriage. That the there's one of my favorite books on marriage by Andrew Cherlin cites the fact that a child born to an unmarried couple in Sweden has almost double the likelihood of living with his same parents at age 18 than a child born to a married couple in California or the United States. We should not confuse longevity commitment with marriage. Some people are finally beginning to say we actually shouldn't confuse marriage with monogamy, but I'll leave that to others to talk about. So I think that we need to be conscious of what it is to be married. Now, one of the things that I have found in working with a lot of couples is that I do a lot of prenups for straight couples, and straight couples, on the whole, understand the basic rules of marriage pretty well. A lot of it, I hope you appreciate my sense of humor, but I have to say that one of the reasons they know about it is that about half of them have already been divorced. So you get a real education in marital law when you get divorced. But a lot of them know from their friends and their relatives what the rules are. So the first thing I say is know what the rules are. And this is about issues of shared debt, shared liability, and sharing. And if you want to opt out of some of them, of course, fine. But really think about it carefully in terms of what these responsibilities are. The other piece of marriage is that it is a commitment that could be a commitment for life. The notions of spousal support and community property are that if you partner with someone and they have a career problem, a health problem, a psychological problem, you have made a commitment, remember, for better or worse. And the state of California can hold you to that commitment by requiring that you pay spousal support. The other piece about marriage, which I know it has not caught on in the gay community, I'm not sure if it's caught on in the straight community either, is the notion of a no-fault divorce. I can't tell you how shocked people are. We're selling our house in the worst market. We're incurring a 10% loss because it's a bad time. And the fact that he had an affair, he doesn't even have to pay the broker's commission, or why is it that I have to, give half of my money to this person who, ran off with our best friend? It's not a popular concept, and there's good state policy for it, but it's hard for people to get used to. The other issue is about parentage, and one of the good rules of the domestic partnership law is that if a woman gives birth or if a man brings a child into his life while they are domestically partnered or married, that partner is presumed to be a parent. That means, first of all, that partner should have a say in whether the person has sperm implanted or hires a surrogate, but it also means that person is on the hook for child support and is involved. And so obviously there are a lot of straight couples who have problems with this issue, but one of the issues in our community is that if you are considering having children and you are domestically partnered or married, that partner is going to be part of your family for the rest of that child's life. And if you don't want to be a co-parent, you shouldn't marry your partner. And I think that some of the issues that have come up in our community have been where people did not understand the totality of the package. One of the other more interesting things, and this is, I think, a wonderful development, although it's confusing to people legally, is the federal government is now starting to recognize same-sex couples and partners and married spouses in California, even despite DOMA. And the most important example of that is the community property income splitting rule. How many of you had to deal with the income splitting rule last year about community property? It basically says that even though the federal government will not recognize your marriage, the community property laws will be recognized and you will each pay taxes based on 50% of the total income. A great movement, actually, and the best thing about it, this is like I don't know if anybody's calculated the windfall, but because the federal government still doesn't treat you as married, you don't have to pay the marriage penalty. So if you're in a couple where one makes a lot more than the other, you may be saving $10,000 to $20,000 on your income taxes until there is recognition. So where does that leave us? It leaves us, first of all, with the most legally complicated situation imaginable for same-sex couples. I mean, I've been dealing with this for, 25 years, and I try to explain it in simple terms. It is still every week I get a question that, I just don't know what the answer is. I have to say to people, you go out and be the test case, and when you get a decision, come back and tell me. Then I'll know the answer to your question. We just don't know how these things are going to pan out. But on the other side, you want to see that complexity as a wonderful opportunity, as a wonderful adventure, and as a time of social change. And that's a good thing. And see it in perspective. And then the last is that marriage, there actually isn't something called same-sex marriage. There isn't gay marriage. There is marriage. And marriage comes with a lot of baggage, a lot of cultural norms, a lot of social expectations. And while we should all be fighting for the right to marry, I hope that no one ever feels they have a duty to marry.
Thank you, Fred Hertz, author of Making It Legal, for joining us this evening. I'm Stephen Seward, chair of the club's LGBT forum, and I'll be moderating today's question period. Fred, we have a large number of questions, okay. So let's begin. You've covered a lot of ground, and there are many important questions, but I suppose there is one question that rises to the top. What is Oprah really like?
Oh, Oprah is wonderful. My partner was there with me. The best thing is what she doesn't do on camera. This was the gay marriage show in 1996, and there were these right-wingers, and there were these the couples from New York and Hawaii, and we were there. And on the break, she turned to the audience, and she said, "What is the problem that these people have?" I mean, it was just this kind of totally natural thing. The other thing I have to tell you about Oprah, and it's a secret that would make all of our lives easier. The show is taped in 10-minute segments with a 15-minute break between segments. And so every segment, there's a break. And then in that break, she is briefed on the next segment in detail. Like, we're going to call on this person, and we're going to call on this person, and he's the lawyer from New York, and she's the person that – it's not scripted. And then they resume the taping. And she deals with that 15 minutes. Imagine if every day of your life you had a 15-minute break between every 10 minutes where five people briefed you on what was going to happen in the next 15 minutes. You'd do a good job, too. Yeah, it was great.
I want to revisit Galinsky because it seems like such an important case. Eric Holder's letter, the Attorney General, said that the administration believes laws disfavoring persons based on sexual orientation should have to pass the most stringent judicial review, heightened scrutiny. Yes. What is heightened scrutiny and why is that important?
So any of you who have been through constitutional law, there is a policy that developed in the last 100 years that the more discriminatory a law was, the more Congress had to justify it. So if all you said was, you know, vodka is taxed at 12% and wine at 5%, so what? But if you're starting to target black people or women, then you really have to have a good reason. So heightened scrutiny is where a law is the most questionable and needs the most justification, and very few discriminatory laws pass that test. And the U.S. Supreme Court has not ruled on whether lesbians and gay people deserve that scrutiny. Let me just say, the other reason why the Glinsky case is so important is these people are employed by the Ninth Circuit. And what's interesting is that the justices voted to give them benefits, and including some very conservative justices. And the Department of Court Personnel, which is part of the administrative offices of the courts, overruled the Ninth Circuit judges. Because in this setting, the justices are the bosses, but the office of the courts is the ruling agency. So you have this bizarre thing where now their own ruling is coming back to them in an appeal.
Yeah, the Office of Personnel Management, headed by openly gay appointee John Barry, instructed the court's insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield, to deny the claim, citing DOMA.
Yes.
So they sort of set it up as a test case? Is that what's
no,
going on?
No. I don't think it was a test case. I think people genuinely wanted it. And part of what's going on, I wouldn't say a test case, but it's a case that a lot of people in the government are hoping they will lose.
And some jurisdictions still adhere to the lower standard of scrutiny, rational basis. Is that because the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in?
Correct. California, at one of the benefits of the Prop 8 case, was a ruling that said that laws against gays and lesbians would have that heightened scrutiny.
The Galinsky case in particular is striking because the administration has really eviscerated DOMA on every count just systematically, haven't they?
The administration. This one lawyer working for the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that, the administration isn't, as I love it, as Obama says, his opinions are evolving.
That's right.
So it's part of the evolution.
Well, do you think that this is evidence of his evolution?
Yes. I think we're seeing, one of the things that we've seen in the last year, in the bankruptcy case, which I didn't talk about, where a couple has been allowed to file a joint bankruptcy petition, and the court said that that was wrong and they should be allowed, and the Department of Justice just decided not to appeal that decision. That's the kind of incremental change we're seeing, where basically they're letting the courts invalidate or at least constrain DOMA.
Is that the Thomas Donovan bankruptcy court?
Yes.
Where 19 of the judges?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Do you think gay marriage or marriage equality is becoming less of a partisan issue? Many prominent Republicans, including Vice President Cheney and Cindy McCain, have come out in favor of it. Michael Bloomberg pushed it through a Republican Senate.
I think it is. I mean, there is a libertarian streak in the Republican Party, which they're finally realizing is a valid approach. And I also think that, the struggles within the Republican Party to create a territory of non-fundamentalist, non-Tea Party, corporate and mainstream Republicanism, being on the side of gay marriage is one of the ways to make that distinction. So I'm not surprised that there is a less conservative wing of the Republican Party, especially in places like New York or California, that are accepting that. Which is clearly what tipped the balance in New York. I mean, it was the Republican shift that led to the result. That's what when I call it winning through losing, because the votes, New York lost 2 years ago, and what's apparently considered to be the change is the focus on getting the Republicans to change, not get the Democrats.
Do you think those few Republicans will be recalled?
Evidence is that people don't get recalled. Although I have to say, quite tragically, in most states people don't get recalled, but tragically, three or four of the justices in Iowa have been recalled. So it's not unheard of.
When you were here in 2009, you spoke of
Judge Von Walker, who had just been assigned the case, as being a confirmed bachelor at the time.
Yeah, I was like, not quite outing him, but that was outing with a very small O, yes.
Months and months ahead of the New York Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. But what do you make of the case against Von Walker today and his sexual orientation?
Oh, this is a ridiculous idea. This belated protest. The proponents of Prop 8 said it's not because he's gay, it's because he told us he has a partner. And therefore he might want to get married. And it was like, well, does that mean that straight people couldn't rule on cases involving straight marriage? So there was an attempt to disqualify him and invalidate the decision, and it was summarily thrown out. I mean, I actually think that the evolution of Von Walker, because for those of us who are been around for a while, he represented the Olympics in the effort to keep the gay Olympics from using the word gay next to the word Olympics. So he's evolved.
And a Reagan appointee?
Yes.
Yeah. You said you think Congress will repeal DOMA in order to avoid a court challenge. However, wouldn't the current conservative Supreme Court be likely to uphold DOMA?
I think that the current Supreme Court, if they ruled on it today, would uphold DOMA. I actually think that a conservative Supreme Court 2 years from now will not uphold DOMA. You look at the Lawrence decision, you look at the Colorado Amendment 2 decision. Again, there is a libertarian streak. The other reason I think they would uphold DOMA is that, keep in mind, one of the things to the aggravation of most progressives is that the issue of federal oversight in state issues, I think if DOMA is going to fail, it's not going to be because it's gay rights. It's going to be that the federal government should not be in the marriage determination business, and that's really where it's going to fall. So it's a close decision. The other, I don't wish ill on any justices, but hopefully there will be some vacancies in the next 2 years, so we may have a different composition of the Supreme Court 2 or 3 years from now.
Do you know something we don't know?
No.
You're not close with Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Or?
That's not the one I'm hoping. There may be some new appointments.
Do you have any thoughts about why the Republican libertarians are beginning to accept same-sex marriage but no shift on abortion?
That's a really interesting question. I guess what I would suggest is that I think much of the Republican and conservative opposition to gay people has been somewhat pumped up and is not as authentically felt by the religious community as the issues of abortion are, and that it has been pumped up by conservatives as a way of rallying the troops, and that as it becomes less effective, people don't care that much, and that you notice that we don't see much concern about premarital sexual activity as being this big issue. We don't see efforts to criminalize sexual activity. I think there is sort of this modern acceptance of sexual activity. I think also that there's been a real cleavage between issues involving kids and issues involving adults. The studies that have shown that the notion that a gay couple could be sexually active and be live next to you and have jobs, people seem to be much less troubled by sexual activity. Once you get into the issues of kids and issues of abortion, I just think that the feelings are just so much stronger. Why, I defer to some of the other experts in the room.
Okay, I'm going to take you all around the country now.
Okay.
Okay, so this person owns a condo in California. I'd like to put the ownership in both of our names. Now we are legally married in California.
Okay.
Community proper with property with right of survivorship.
That's easy.
Will the IRS assert a gift tax obligation since we are Texas residents?
Actually, that was on our listserv question just the other day. And the expectation is that while the property – first of all, if you're not a California resident, I'm not sure you can take title as community property with right of survivorship, because if the title company finds out that you're Texas residents, they won't. It actually isn't community property, because community property goes to the situs of the couple, not the property. So I don't think you can take it as community property. And the other is, the according to Pat Kane, who is the wisest person on tax issues, she believes that the IRS recognition of community property and other marriage rights will only extend to couples who live in recognition states. So I think the answer is, your IRS, again, deferring to state law, is because tax law refers to state property law, and I think, therefore, it's your status where you live, which is Texas, in which your marriage is not recognized, you will not get the federal tax benefits.
And on a similar topic, after DOMA is repealed, the Fed applies only to recognition states. What about a married academic couple, one in a non-recognition state and the other in a recognition state?
Don't get audited. I think that the issue there is normally, and this is one of the problems that comes from having an inconsistency between state and federal law, which is that the federal law does not envision a couple having two residences. And what I would say for that couple is they should declare one of the states as the primary residence of both of them, whichever is tax advantageous, and dare the IRS to question that.
If the Prop 8 sponsors are not granted standing, is the case over?
The appeal is dismissed. What the question then is, what does it mean that the case is over? Some people have said that having the appeal haven't been granted, the trial court decision actually is voided, and there is no decision, and it all has to start over. I don't think that's the right answer. But there are some people who have said that, technically speaking, once the appeal was granted, the trial court decision becomes void. I don't think so. I think what happens is the trial court decision is honored. The question then is, what is the scope of the decision? It's probably good statewide, and probably Governor Brown would honor it. So I think while there may be a couple of months of legal contortions, I think effectively it's over, and I think what would happen is the governor and the attorney general would declare it a victory, and I don't think any court would undo it. So in fact, I think the marriage door, the front door of marriage, would reopen.
And then is that a precedent-setting case that could be used in another?
No. Because only trial court decisions are not precedential.
Okay.
So it would not be precedential. But keep in mind, there is no other state that allows constitutionally protected rights to be taken away by a bare majority of the voters. So there is no other state for which it's a relevant precedent anyways.
Was Judge Walker the first judge to hold a trial on the merits?
No, actually in Hawaii they did as well. I don't know, Judy, did you testify in Hawaii?
No, Andrew Sherlin is
trying to be a
history.
There was a trial in Hawaii where the state was put on trial to justify its ban on marriage, and that's one of the reasons why the state lost, is that their evidence was so flimsy. So Walker was the second to do it.
Okay. Was the outcome similar in Hawaii?
Yes. Well, the trial court outcome was the same. What was different was Hawaii had no marriage. The trial court said there had to be marriage, and then there was a constitutional amendment to take it away. In California, we had court-ordered marriage that then the voters took away, that then the court reinstated. So same technical decision, but in a different trajectory.
What about immigration and marriage?
Oh, this is a really sad situation. I think it's very poignant and is one of the most compelling things. And there have been attempts to get around DOMA, but there was a bill called the Permanent Partners Bill. There was an attempt to do it, and if you've seen the press in the last couple of months, the good news is that the Department of Justice has put a cessation on deportation. But let me just say something politically, which is, and I encourage you all to be in touch with Feinstein's office, because there actually are going to be hearings. I was really excited. I got a call while I was standing in line at the grocery store from somebody who's looking for witnesses to come and testify to announce that there's going to be hearings on the repeal of DOMA starting on July 20th. And I hope that the immigration issue will be mentioned. There's a lot of fear that there's such hostility to immigrants that we shouldn't mention the immigration issue, but hopefully it will. The other thing to know is that while the deportations are under cessation now, I still don't think it's at all certain that gay couples and lesbian couples are going to be protected until DOMA is repealed.
Once marriage equality is realized, is the struggle over?
Well, in my practice, the struggle begins because I'm trying to help couples figure out what to do. Does the political struggle end? I would say that it changes dramatically. I think that there was a lot of discussion in the Jewish community in the 1960s, as well as there a need for an anti-defamation league. You know, I think if you sat around with leaders in the African-American community in 1955, and they said, oh, should we dismantle the NAACP now that we have Brown versus Board of Education? I think the last 50 years have shown that this kind of what I'll call formal recognition is a long ways from full social acceptance. So it's an important step. It's a change of dynamic. But I don't think, I think especially if you look at, other parts of the country, let alone other parts of the world. I mean, my hope is that all the money being spent to legalize marriage now can be used to help some of the people in Iran and Uganda who need help desperately.
Is it ever proper to put the rights of a minority group up for public vote?
No.
Okay.
That was easy.
What should be front of mind for couples considering marriage that perhaps they didn't need to consider before?
Every relationship ends either in death or divorce. And if you don't plan the legal aspects of the death or divorce, and you don't know which is going to happen first, if you don't plan it, the state of the legislature of California already has. And before you get married, you should learn what they have in mind for you, because you actually can make changes. And that's, I think, the most important thing, is to learn what the state plan is and see if you like it. And if you don't like it, either do a prenup or choose not to marry.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Same-Sex Marriage and Its Equivalents with civil rights attorney and author Fred Hertz. And Fred, we've unfortunately reached that point in the program where there is time for only one last question. And I'd like to know, is gay divorce different from heterosexual divorce?
Yes. And here are where we're seeing the differences. First of all, since a lot of people don't even know they're under marital law, they're shocked when they learn the rules, I had this discussion with a therapist. So how is an outraged straight guy who knew he was married but doesn't want to pay alimony different than an outraged gay man who didn't know that he was under marital law? And I think there is a difference in the outrage. Second, we still have a lot of federal non-recognition problems around taxes, around retirement benefits, around transfers of retirement benefits. Third, we have a lot of couples who, having been excluded from legal mainstream, have very unconventional lives. I met with a couple this week where their child has 5 functional parents: his bio dad, his bio mom, a lesbian friend of the bio dad, the lesbian mom's lover, the bio dad's ex-boyfriend, who was in the child's life for 10 years, and the bio dad's soon-to-be ex-boyfriend.
And that child has five parental figures. And the law doesn't know how to deal with those kinds of complexities around custody, child support. So we're going to see a lot of problems. And then the last piece is that while you have some straight couples who lived together and then got married, any long-term same-sex couple will, by law definition, have been together unmarried, and their non-marital period in California is covered by non-marital law, which has very different outcomes than marital law. And so when you have a couple who's breaking up, it's often advantageous to one to say, oh, we were only married 5 years. Those first 15 years don't count. And then his or her partner will say, what? You're using the homophobic ban on same-sex marriage against me, your homosexual lover. It does not go down well. So those are the main differences.
Okay. Our thanks to Fred Hertz, author of the NOLO Press Guide, Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions, for his participation in tonight's program.
Thank you very much. So just so you know, there are about 15 copies of the book in the other room at a discount. You can buy them there. I'm happy to autograph them. Or we have a coupon here, and we encourage you to buy from NOLO. You will pay sales tax, but you'll be helping the state of California.
We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.